and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on a dispute between Porter County officials that could wind up in court. Indiana lags behind the national average for COVID-19 vaccines. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Indiana University Northwest Professor of Economics, Micah Pollack. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The city of Chicago is suing a Gary gun store, contending it has sold hundreds of guns to straw buyers that have ended up in the hands of felons or at crime scenes in the city. The lawsuit, filed Monday in Illinois, seeks a court order requiring Westforth Sports, Inc. to cease practices contributing to gun trafficking, as well as unspecified damages. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot says research by the city and federal law enforcement partners shows Westforth Sports is selling thousands of crime guns every year. She added, the time for asking them to stop has passed. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Porter County Assessor John Snyder said as a Republican who supports lower property taxes, he likes the concept behind newly approved state legislation aimed at protecting taxpayers from immediate hikes in land assessments following a successful appeal. But he is so concerned about the way it was carried out by State Representative Ed Soliday that he is considering taking legal action. Times reports, part of what Snyder referred to was the discovery that Soliday had been claiming a homestead credit on two residences at the same time. The error was blamed on the county auditor's office, and Soliday later repaid the difference. Snyder said a sales disclosure signed by Soliday claims he did not have another homestead to vacate. The legislation in question, House and Road Act 1166, bars a county assessor from immediately hiking a property tax assessment the property owner successfully challenged at the county or state assessment appeals board in the prior tax year. Snyder said the legislation aimed at bad assessors was based on falsehoods. Republican Governor Eric Holcomb is expected to sign the plan into law. It will take effect for the tax year beginning January 1st.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indiana lags behind the national average of COVID-19 vaccines, with just less than 27% of the state's total population fully vaccinated. When pointing to more rural zip codes, health officials said they're working with the Indiana Rural Health Association to help improve. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says access is only one of the barriers.
I believe truly it has a little bit more to do with vaccine hesitancy than it has to do with the access there. But I always say you can't say it's about vaccine hesitancy until you've made sure that you've made the access appropriate.
While officials have not set a benchmark for herd immunity, Indiana Department of Health Chief Medical Officer Dr. Lindsay Weaver says it is achievable that Indiana hits herd immunity in 2021. But she says experts are concerned about the consequences if we don't.
What the CDC has been talking about, and we've heard other experts say that they are concerned about another large spike in the fall. So if you have not been vaccinated, then of course your risk of getting sick, being hospitalized, and even dying is much higher than the people who have been vaccinated.
State health officials made a few name changes to the state's vaccine rollout Wednesday. Indiana is encouraging the state vaccine providers to accept walk-ins and working to get primary care providers access to vaccines.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Governor Eric Holcomb sued the Indiana General Assembly Tuesday over legislation that would give lawmakers more authority to intervene during a public emergency. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the lawsuits filed in Marion County Court.
Many lawmakers felt sidelined during the COVID-19 pandemic as the governor issued dozens of executive orders, some of which legislators openly opposed. To give themselves more opportunity to intervene in the future, lawmakers passed a bill that allows them to call a special session of the General Assembly during a public emergency. But Holcomb, supported by some constitutional experts, believes the Indiana Constitution exclusively gives the governor that power, and he's suing to find out for sure. There is no timetable for how the lawsuit will play out, though Holcomb, in his filing, says the constitutional question should be answered as soon as possible. He says the law creates uncertainty and confusion, and its consequences could be severe. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Legislative leaders say the lawsuit is not a surprise. They call the issue a, quote, fundamental disagreement with the governor.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana lawmakers are calling the budget they passed this legislative session historic, largely because of the education funding included in it. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay explains the General Assembly also made changes to school accountability that gives local leaders more control to address poor school performance.
Equal means everybody receives the same. Equity means everybody receives what they need. And that's where we need to keep our focus on education.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb has signed a controversial bill into law that takes away state protections for many of Indiana's wetlands. Wetlands provide habitat for wildlife, but also help control flooding and recharge the state's aquifers. The law removes protections for a whole class of smaller wetlands and nixes some for another class of wetlands that the state considers somewhat rare or ecologically important. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management estimates more than 80% of the state's wetlands fall into these two categories. Supporters of the new law say Indiana's current wetland protections are too strict, causing home prices to go up and creating conflicts between farmers and state environmental regulators. But more than 100 different groups sent a letter to Holcomb this week asking him to veto the bill. In an email statement, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce said it was surprising and disappointing that the governor signed the legislation. The law also creates a task force to study some of the issues behind the bill. The chamber said lawmakers should have let the task force do its work before making changes.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana will remain at 9 congressional districts for the next decade after national and state census figures were released Monday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the Indiana data from the U.S. Census Bureau's announcement.
The number of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives is 435, so when a census is conducted every 10 years, the number of seats each state gets can shift based on population changes. Indiana's population grew by about 300,000, almost 5%. That puts it in the bottom half of the 50 states for population growth over the last decade. And that also means the number of congressional districts will stay at 9, where it's been since 2003. The most congressional seats Indiana has ever had is 13, from the 1870s through the early 1930s. State lawmakers will redraw congressional and state legislative district lines later this year after the Census Bureau releases further information. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
President Biden's American Rescue Plan provides $1.9 trillion to help the country recover from the coronavirus pandemic. Part of the plan includes an expanded child tax credit for 2021 that will provide direct payments to parents. The IRS announced earlier this month those will start in July. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Mitch Ligon reports that for many families, the relief cannot come soon enough.
Every day, life seems to be inching closer to normal. The weather's getting warmer, businesses are hiring, and more people are getting vaccinated. But in the Carey household on Bloomington's south side, things are far from normal.
Matthew, you have a class.
Eliza Carey was working full-time as a retail manager when the pandemic hit.
Hopefully I'll be able to go full-time soon. I was talking to my boss about it.
School went virtual and her kids' grades started slipping.
I was like, okay, this is not going to work. it's not, especially with them being home and them needing my attention. So now I'm part-time with IU Health.
It's been a trade-off. She now has time to help with things like schoolwork, but it's harder to make ends meet. Jessica Frazier, director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, says it's the same situation in countless Hoosier households.
Low to moderate income families are still having those impacts. In some ways, it's even worse because service sector workers were so impacted by this particular downturn.
Over 800,000 Hoosiers live in poverty, and more than a quarter of them are children. For a family of four, that's an annual income of less than about $26,000. Those numbers are pre-pandemic, though. Many Hoosiers, including Carey, are worse off now than before, and the impact on children could be long-lasting.
There's lots of research out there that, you know, when families live in poverty, it has detrimental effects on children. They are more likely to live in poverty in their adulthood.
According to some experts, the expanded credit could cut child poverty in half. It'll increase the child tax credit to $3,600 per child under six, and $3,000 for kids up to 17. To get the aid out faster, the IRS is sending half the credit as direct payments. According to Brad Heim, Executive Associate Dean of IU's O'Neill School, it's a strategy that hasn't been tried in the U.S. before.
And so it's structured very similarly to kind of a guaranteed basic income idea. You know, often guaranteed basic incomes apply to everyone. You know, this is kind of a guaranteed basic income for kids in particular.
The credit is now fully refundable, meaning more families will benefit. Originally, you could only get the credit if you paid a certain amount in taxes, meaning many of the poorest families who needed help the most weren't eligible.
The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimate that 1.4 million Hoosier children under 18 will benefit from this expansion in some way.
Those same estimates say the expanded credit will lift 80,000 Indiana children above the poverty line. Currently, most of the money Carey makes goes toward her rent. SNAP benefits help with groceries. She says the expanded credit and monthly payments will go a long way for people living paycheck to paycheck.
To be able to pay bills on time and to be able to save some money, you know what I'm saying? So, and I've never been, you know, staying above water. I've never been able to do that, save. So I'm really excited about that.
And the impacts of lifting children out of poverty are hard to understate. They're more likely to graduate high school and go to college and less likely to be involved in criminal activity. They tend to live longer and healthier lives. The list continues.
As a parent, you always want your kids to be better than you. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I want for them.
The expansion is only set to last this year, though, since it's part of the larger COVID Recovery Act. But prominent Democrats, including the president, have said they'd like to see it stick around as part of broader anti-poverty efforts. A few Republicans have pitched similar programs, but say the current iteration of the credit will encourage government dependence and lead to inflation.
If you're writing off $3,000 per kid, you know, for huge numbers of families, I mean, that's, you know, for a lot of families, that's the entire tax bill, and then you're sending money out the door.
Politicians will be debating the expansion's effectiveness soon enough. Payments haven't been sent out yet, but they're giving many Hoosier families optimism for the future. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Mitch Ligon.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Indiana University Northwest professor Micah Pollack.
Micah Pollack is a professor of economics at Indiana University Northwest with a campus in Gary, and he's taken to Twitter in many months, it seems, for at least certainly since the start of the pandemic, to look into some of the data that has come out in turn dealing with the coronavirus pandemic that we are facing these days. And he is with us to talk about some of the newest information and maybe some other thoughts, too, about what we've all been experiencing lately from the CDC about the vaccinations, as well as, I guess, the guidance that's come out recently about mask wearing. And first off, Micah, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Well, if you will, start out first. Give us some of the latest data that you have come up with that you put out there on your Twitter feed that give us some guidance or some ideas, at least, on how the effectiveness of vaccines have been doing.
Yeah, so I've been really enjoying switching from tracking cases and infections and hospitalizations to looking more at vaccination rates. It's a much more uplifting and positive thing to look at, and we've been doing quite well. We recently went through, I guess you would call it the third wave or the fourth wave in cases here in Indiana and Northwest Indiana in particular, and it was very mild. It started in the middle of March. We kind of peaked in early April, and cases are back declining again, positivity rates dropping, and a big reason for that is that we've been doing really well in vaccinations. And so the people that traditionally would have gotten sick, the older groups, the higher risk groups, they're more or less vaccinated now, and so there really wasn't anywhere for the virus to go, and we had a very mild wave here.
I know that the latest information that comes out from the Indiana Department of Health and the color-coded maps, which is what I think most people will get a chance to take a look at and try and figure out how they're doing in the state, or at least in particular counties, show that we have some counties that things have gotten better and some counties that things suddenly turn worse. But that's just a very, very quick and very short snapshot, is it not, of what the real situation's like?
Yeah, and they also tend to lag a little bit because they're only updated once a week based on, you know, data from a few days earlier than that. So when you're looking at that snapshot, you could be looking at data from over a week ago, and it's really in the last 1.5 weeks or so that things have really started to improve. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see those color charts improving across the state in the next, you know, week or so here.
In what information you've gathered, as well as what you take a look at from the state and on the national level, do you think that we're in this situation now, that the CDC guidance that just came out here about mask wearing and how to protect yourself from the virus have changed a little bit, but it's certainly looking more positive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're well on the path to returning to normal or very close to normal over this summer, which I'm really excited about. I mean, there's still some uncertainty out there with variants and, you know, with the global spread happening the way it is, there's always a chance that something more severe could arise. But I think that, you know, barring anything like that, we're in a good place and we're on track to have something very close to a normal summer.
I know that you've joined with other of your professors at Indiana University, and I'm sure other campuses, as need be, to take a look at the data that has come out and put together what turned out to be a very interesting paper that just recently got out about infectious diseases and in particular about COVID-19. You took a look in specifics about Indiana. Will you tell us first the objective that you all had put together in getting the data together as well as doing the study itself?
Sure. So back in the summer of 2020, as schools were thinking about reopening and how they would do the reopening, we kind of saw an opportunity to look at how different districts reopening in different ways affected the spread of the coronavirus in those communities. So if you have a community that, you know, does primarily e-learning, do you see a reduction in cases there? And if you have a school district that goes primarily in person, do you see a large spike in cases there? And so we were able to collect data from all the school districts in Indiana on how they were planning on reopening, and then combine that with the case data from the State Department of Health and look at over the fall how different reopening plans affected the spread of the virus in those communities.
When you obviously had enough information together to start out the work on this, what did you and your colleagues that were working on the study put together? What information did you gather together? What types of information, I should say, that you gathered together to be able to come up with enough data to be able to show how the spread of the COVID-19 has been around not only communities and counties, but also the schools as well?
Yeah, so we actually individually contacted every school district in the state of Indiana and got data from them on when their school district was going to reopen and what their plans were and how many students they would have in person versus doing e-learning. And going into this, I think I expected that we would probably see a pretty significant effect, right? If you have a lot of students sitting in a classroom in a school every day, even with precautions, that has to lead to more spread, I thought, than, you know, when everybody's at home doing their learning remote, where, you know, spread obviously can't happen. And so going into this, I really expected that, you know, more in-person school districts would have substantially more spread in the communities. And we see a significant effect, but it's relatively small. It turned out to be relatively minor, which was, I think, surprising for me.
Now, I know the conclusion of the paper says that, I guess, there are concerns, I guess, about the spread, of course, of the virus, but it's not as much as what maybe at the start of the school, for both, I guess all school systems for that matter, in Indiana this year, have really turned out to be. What did you discover along the way that got you to the conclusions?
Well, there was a lot of controversy going in because there wasn't much data and analysis and research on this topic, and so people kind of, you know, took their own personal views and assume that that was going to be what happens. And so, you know, a lot of people thought schools are going to be super spreader events, and others thought, no, there's not going to be that much spread and we need in-person instruction. And so our goal with this was really to try to quantify how much being in person actually affects the spread of COVID-19 in the community to help school districts and parents and teachers better understand the risks they were being exposed to. So we could tell them something like, well, if you have, you know, 10% more students in your classroom, is that going to lead to, how many new cases is that going to lead to in your community? Is it going to be a lot? Is it going to be small? And the goal is to try to put numbers on this so that you can have a discussion about, you know, the relative costs and benefits of being in person versus e-learning, rather than just kind of everyone taking a stance that's not supported by it necessarily by any research and fighting about it.
Now, of course, you being an economist are looking at the cost of the all of this, not only of trying to deal with the virus, but also trying to get schools reopened in many, many cases. Did you find that there was enough information that you all got together, and certainly you did from your part of the study, to show whether it would be a good idea for school districts to go ahead and reopen? Or did you feel, well, we have to have more information, we have to know more about what types of schools should reopen maybe, rather than all the schools in a school district?
We were very careful with this, not to be prescriptive and say schools should be in person or shouldn't. Our goal was to say, okay, here are the results. Here is the effect of being in person more. And it's ultimately a decision that depends on what the parents feel is safe, what the school district feels is safe, whether they decide it's worth being in person or not.
Now, are you going to be able to take the information from this study as well as the conclusion back to the school districts, if they haven't done so already, to say this is what you can do? If you want to look at the data in more detail, that's fine. You can kind of extrapolate it across to all of your particular students and teachers and administrators in a district and just make the decision that way.
Yeah, I think we've had a lot of interest from school districts and teachers in this study. I think, you know, optimistically, in some sense, it'll be moot, though, because hopefully in the fall, we won't have a lot of spread. We'll have most of the population vaccinated, even some of the kids. And so I'm really hopeful that while the study was really interesting and fascinating to work on, that in the end, maybe it won't even be needed because things will hopefully be back to normal in the fall.
Is that hope that the CDC guidelines that came out recently are going to be enough to certainly make enough people happy enough to know that they can in certain cases they can remove the masks, they can continue cleaning as they should to make things sanitary as they can for everybody, but not have to go overboard?
Yeah, hopefully, and it's going to be a gradual process, just, you know, physically reopening, but also mentally preparing for this. And I think that we're only starting to see the overwhelming evidence of the effectiveness of the vaccine. So this most recent spike that we saw in Indiana, Northwest Indiana, if you break it down by age group, it was almost entirely flat for everyone over the age of 60. There was no rise in cases whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And the entire spike was driven by those under the age of 60, primarily because those over the age of 60 were already 50% or above vaccinated. And so when you see kind of that stark contrast of once you get that population group to 50 or 60% vaccinated, cases just are not there anymore. As we roll out the vaccine and we get more people vaccinated, I think over the summer we'll be all become more comfortable seeing case numbers drop and never come back up again, hopefully, because of the vaccine.
Now, I guess you all at the time, of course, didn't have all the information necessary to know about what kind of impact that the variants might have on Indiana schools. Do you think that's something that's going to be the next question that'll have to be answered?
Yeah, so that's one of our limitations is we did this during the fall before there were really widespread variants. And of course, recently with the UK variant, the B117 variant in Michigan in particular has been very severe and led to a lot of hospitalizations and increases in cases. But in Indiana, we are close to Michigan, actually, in terms of the number of B117 cases. So right now we're looking at about 70 to 80% of all cases in Indiana are probably the UK variant. And, you know, that hasn't really affected us the same way it has in Michigan. You know, we saw a small rise, we saw a small spike, but, you know, the vaccine is effective against all the variants so far. And, you know, there's no reason to think that, you know, it won't be unless something dramatic happens. And so I think we're probably in a good shape. I don't think it'll fundamentally change the nature of our results, you know, if you include the B117 variant.
Well, Micah, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this.
Great. Thank you so much, Chris.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.